Let's talk scout notes on the Victorian Internet by Tom Standage. This is a book from 1998, and the subtitle of this book, which will give you a pretty good idea what it's about, is The Remarkable Story of the Telegraph and the 19th Century's Online Pioneers. Now, when I think of this book, the first thing I think of is the way that we envision things that are coming. We usually envision them based on what we already know. For example, what's this? You know, it's a meat I've never tasted before. What's it taste like? It tastes like chicken. Or here's a new band you've never heard of. They sound like Bob Dylan if he was in the Rolling Stones. Which, by the way, sounds pretty awesome. I would listen to that band. But we can also look at it in terms of technology. In particular, we can even narrow that down even more and look at Apple. When the iPhone first came out, there were buttons. I mean, there were icons, not buttons. Icons on the screen that looked three-dimensional. That three-dimensional look where they look like things in the real world is called skeuomorphism. Like one of the famous stories is the original, I think it was the either the Contacts app or the Notes app had this leather stitching or pretend leather stitching on it, and it was designed to look like the leather stitching inside of Steve Jobs' Gulfstream jet. A more simple example, when the Notes app first came out, it didn't look the way it looks now. It looked like a legal pad of paper. It looked like a yellow piece of paper with the blue lines across it. This is skeuomorphism. This is not skeuomorphism, but an example of using the past to understand the future is the Apple Pencil. It's not really a pencil, right? A pencil is a piece of wood that has graphite inside of it. But we call this stylus an Apple Pencil because using the term pencil relates it to the past. It makes it easier for people to, in some way, digest the idea of a stylus. The thing is, we even graph our past onto our predictions about the future. Not just objects, but the future itself, what it will look like. Think about science fiction films. Most science fiction films, the way the future looks is in some way stylized after something in the past. You know, you see classic cars or future cars that are shaped like classic cars. Like, oh, it looks like a 57 Chevy, but it's, you know, it's a flying car. For example, in The Fifth Element, Bruce Willis's character is driving a yellow taxi cab, and the yellow taxi cab looks like the classic taxi cab from like the 80s and the 70s and maybe even the 60s, the one that you would see in the TV show Taxi. Even though it's a flying car and it's the future, it looks like that. Another example, Art Deco buildings you'd see in a lot of movies. One of the original science fiction films, maybe the first science fiction film, Metropolis. Everything in that is a vision of the future, but everything is Art Deco, which was actually going back in time for them as well. Or anytime you see a future, like a big metropolis in a science fiction film, they always look like some kind of amped up mix between Tokyo and Times Square. It doesn't look alien or foreign, right? It looks like something familiar. And the reason for that is it's kind of hard to just make something that doesn't reference the past. The only way that things like that happen is naturally. There's a strange vacuum in the vision of how things develop. For example, think about Star Trek: The Next Generation. On that show, Picard, which is played by Patrick Stewart, he read books, paper books. And this is supposed to be, 300 years in the future. But 300 years in the future as of like actually the time of this book, 1998, the 90s. But he's walking around with paper books. Do we really think that's going to be happening in 300 years? Probably not. He was doing it as some sort of anachronism. You know, it wasn't like you saw other characters with paper books. My point here is he's walking around and what is he reading? He's reading Moby Dick. Nobody else in the show, as far as I can remember, walks around with paper books. And any reference to reading is always a reference to a book that we would already know here in this time, back 300 years ago for them. There's not a lot of references. In fact, I can't think of a single reference to any books written in their time. So we don't even know if they're writing books then. We don't know if, are there novelists 300 years in the future? So even that filtering of the future has to be done through the past, because what would that look like? We don't know. I guess a way to say this as well is, it's very difficult for people making TV shows and movies and things like this to design these things. And obviously, we're not looking for accuracy here, because they can't be accurate. It's something that doesn't exist. This future doesn't exist. But it's hard for them to be accurate to the foreignness of what the future will look like without losing the audience. What I mean by that is, if you took somebody from 1800s, we'll say 1867, just throw a random year out there to make it concrete. You take somebody from 1867 and you drop them into Austin, Texas, 2023, New York City, 2023. Take them to a place where people are walking around with phones, with tablets. You're gonna lose them. They can't even connect to it, because what they're seeing isn't relatable in any way. So many things that are different that are not comparable to their time. So if you were to make a movie that actually accurately represents how much time can actually change our reality, it would be very difficult for people to watch, because we watch things we relate to. That's also how we deal with the future. Going back to Star Trek: The Next Generation, what do these people do in the holodecks, these essentially virtual reality realms? What they're doing is not any different than how we would probably use them if they invented them today. You know, they play a game in there. I can't remember the game they play, but it would be like if we had it now and we played tennis, like Wii Tennis, right? Except in three dimension, golf. We'd go on adventure. We'd take a book and make it into, Picard does. We would take a detective noir novel and make it into a 3D experience that we can live through, that we can, you know, play. It's not any different than how we would use it. But in reality, what would happen is, if this technology exists, it would develop its own forms. And the forms that it would develop would be nothing that would be relatable to us, because it would be a form native to that medium. And since we don't know that medium, we don't know what can develop from it. I know this is all abstract. Trust me, we're getting somewhere where this will become more concrete. I just want to lay down these fundamental ideas so that when we break into more concrete examples, all of this can kind of cascade together. As I said, in reality, the medium develops its own form. Television. When you look at television shows, originally what people thought was that television was just going to be like movies. It's just going to be movies on a small screen. It's just, there's not going to be any difference in the form. It's going to be the same thing. Or they thought it was going to be like the radio dramas that were on the radio. It'll just be the same thing. And the radio dramas and the movies, when those were made, people thought they were just going to be like plays. But they weren't. Movies are something different than plays. In Japanese culture, when they first started making films, they originally filmed their movies like plays. And what I mean by that is, they would put the camera in one place and never move it. And then they would perform in front of the camera, just like you were an audience member sitting in a chair. Now, we know that's not what happened. It developed past that. What happened was, movies developed their own form. The cameras moved. The cameras panned up. The cameras panned to the side, zoomed in, zoomed out. Then we got into the era of the handheld cameras. So you had shows like Homicide: Life on the Street, where they're filming on hand cameras. So it felt like you were a person moving through the scene with these other people. Or like the Evil Dead movies, and I think it's the first one, they had no money, but they wanted the sense that they were running through the woods behind someone. But, you know, like the camera they had didn't have image stabilization. So what they did is, they secured the camera onto a 2x4, and then they hold either ends of the 2x4. And then when they ran, it stabilized it somewhat, but it still gave it enough of that shake to feel like you were a person running through the woods. These are forms that developed from the medium itself. They weren't inherited from the things behind them, like radio or the plays. In the same way, television is different than all of those, in particular movies, because you can tell a story for a longer period of time. So you can do something like Breaking Bad. You can't do what happens in Breaking Bad in 2.5 hours. You can't even do it in 6 hours. You have to do it over seasons, episodes, years, to watch this character slowly go from one thing to the other in a believable manner. You couldn't have 24-hour news. Theoretically, you could have had it on the radio, but it just never happened. So television comes along, in particular cable television, and that medium inspires the form of 24-hour news, CNN. The sitcom did not exist before television. The sitcom is a form that developed out of the medium of television itself. So I'm bringing up these examples again because these are ways that looking at the past did not tell us what the future would look like. What will come will be nothing like what we predict because the future is often unprecedented. Which brings me to an article that I read a long time ago, but it has stuck in my head for years. It's possible I read this the year that it was written. I believe it was written in 2012. The article is called Welcome to the Future, Nauseous. This is by a guy named Venkatesh Rao, who's a very, very intelligent human being. And it's from his website, which I believe now is a Substack, called Ribbon Farm. R-I-B-B-O-N. Just in case my pronunciation was a little mumbled there. These first two small paragraphs were so perfect that I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to go with the quote. Both science fiction and futurism seem to miss an important piece of how the future actually turns into the present. They fail to capture the way we don't seem to notice when the future actually arrives. Let me read that sentence again. It's an important sentence. They, as in science fiction and futurism, fail to capture the way that we don't seem to notice when the future actually arrives. In other words, the future is already here. More of the quote. Sure, we can all see small cues all around us. Cell phones, laptops, Facebook, Prius cars on the street. Yet somehow, the future always seems like something that is going to happen rather than something that is happening. I think that's a very important point. And it goes back to what I was saying about using the past. The reason we use the past for that is because we're developing something, not purposefully, although sometimes you can, like a skeuomorphism is an example of doing this purposefully. And in the article, you should read the article, but he says, you know, there's three ways that this is done, but what you're manufacturing is something called a manufactured normalcy field. You're creating a sense of everything is normal. Everything is static. Everything is staying the same. So you don't seem to notice that the future is here because we live in this static state where everything is just like, well, this is just now. And we don't think of what now means in the context of what we thought was the future an hour ago, a day ago, a month ago, a year ago, 10 years ago. So we live in this constant state of a manufactured normalcy field. And skeuomorphism is an example of purposefully trying to maintain that, but then there's things that we do psychologically and then things that society does. Often what this means is that the future is translated into familiar terms, translated into things that we already know, instead of just being understood on its own terms, because it's hard to understand the future on its own terms, because as I said, the future is unprecedented often. The purpose of this manufactured normalcy field is to preserve a comfortable sense of familiarity. This is comfort. We want to feel comfortable. We don't want to feel lost in our own time, which actually often happens to people as they get older because they can't adapt to this manufactured normalcy field. The things that are being referenced to the manufactured normalcy field are no longer a reference for them. So they're too far out of the reach of the field. They're outside of the field, so they start to hate technology. So we want to preserve this comfortable sense of familiarity around us because things around us are changing rapidly. Pretty much an understatement. Here's another quote from the Venkatesh Rao article. I now possess a cell phone that works better than Captain Kirk's communicator, but I don't feel like I'm living in the future that I imagined back then. He's not saying that the cell phone, something wrong with the cell phone is why he doesn't feel like he's living in the future. Like, oh, it doesn't live up to the future that he imagined back then. What he's saying is He had this sense of what the future would be back then when he saw Captain Kirk with this communication device in his hand. And now he has a communication device in his hand that's way better than what Kirk had. What Kirk had was essentially a walkie-talkie. I don't know if they still use them on job sites, construction job sites, but they used to have the beep-beep, and then they would talk. I can't remember what they were called. Nextel? I think they were called Nextels. That's basically what Captain Kirk has. He didn't have this device that you could play games on, that you could draw on, that you could listen to music on, that you could ask questions of, that you can talk to an artificial intelligence on, that you could call, that you could text, you could take photos with it. He didn't have that. This is far more advanced than what people in the 1960s imagined the future would look like. Yet when we look at it, we don't look at it and go, whoa, man, I'm in the future. It's normal. It's mundane. That's the manufacturer normalcy field. Now, all of this brings us around to the book, The Victorian Internet. As I said earlier, this was written in 1998. And essentially what the book is trying to compare is the emerging internet and the telegraph. Yeah, there's a lot of similarities there. But what I see now in 2023, when I read this book, especially one small part that I'm going to focus on completely, I see something that we can learn about AI, the emergence of AI in the telegraph, in the story of the telegraph. There are a lot of predictions about what AI is going to be, what's going to happen. It's the best thing in the world. It's going to solve every problem, or it's going to destroy humanity and everything in between. But just like everything else I've said about the future, we have no way of knowing what it's going to look like or how it's going to develop, because once again, for the third time, I say the future is often unprecedented. And the reason that this telegraph, the story of the telegraph, reminds me of this moment right now is because when the telegraph first came out, people didn't understand what the telegraph was. With the exception of the people pretty much who developed it, nobody got it. Nobody understood what it was. They understood that things were being sent, but they didn't understand what that meant. What was the implication of that? How did it work? They didn't understand any of that. So people were bringing packages. I think there's a story in the book of someone bringing a cake to a telegraph operator and asking them to telegraph it to a loved one, not understanding that you can't telegraph a cake. There's another story of a daughter asking the mother, how do the letters go through the wires and not get ripped when they turn? And the mother's answer, not condescending to her child, but honestly answered that they go in liquid form, because that's the only way she could reason how this letter was traveling. There's another story of someone who had, I think it was her son, send her a telegraph, and she got the telegraph. What would happen is the telegraph operators would, they get the signal, and when they get the signal, they would, transcribe that into letters. Obviously when you get a telegraph, you don't want dot dash dash dot dot dash dash dash. You want to know what the letters are. You don't want to have to learn Morse code. So when the woman got the message from her son, she didn't believe it. She said, because this isn't his handwriting, because she didn't understand. I would venture to say everyone listening to this right now is able to understand that I am not physically transporting into your ears. You understand the abstract idea of sending a signal, not even through wires anymore, but through the air. So when we hear stories of people not comprehending this, they sound stupid, but they aren't. The thing is, they did not understand what it meant to send something in a non-physical way. Why? Because they had never heard of anything like that before. That idea didn't exist before. They had absolutely no point of comparison. What could you point them to that existed before that would tell them that you can send something without, there was no precedent. Most people didn't understand how light waves work. They didn't understand how sound waves travel in the air. So the idea of something traveling from place to place in a non-physical manner was something they could not compute. It was outside of their manufactured normalcy field. And as I said, it seems now, like it's easy for me to explain it to somebody now. I just say, well, you see, they're not sending the physical letter, the physical paper. They're just sending the words. They're just sending, you know, what it says. They're sending the idea. But imagine trying to explain that to someone who doesn't know what that means, what it means to be able to just send an idea. That's what I think relates to AI. AI is unprecedented. And the way we're looking at it is like people trying to conceptualize paper letters being sent through the wire in liquid form. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it's going to develop. It's going to be a medium that creates its own forms. It's going to be something beyond our comprehension. So did the internet, let's go back to the internet, for example, did the internet develop just like the telegraph? You know, that's our metaphor of this book here. Was the development of the internet the same as the thing that's being compared to before it? No. There's similarities, but the development is far, far, far different. The internet had effects that couldn't be foreseen, both positive and negative, but almost all entirely unprecedented. In 2012, when Venkatesh Rao wrote his article, he predicted an impending state called the future nausea, which is where the title comes from. Welcome to the future nausea. What he was predicting is that eventually this rapid changing or advancement of things around us would happen so fast that eventually it would pop the manufacturer normalcy field. And then we would all become overwhelmed. We would, instead of being future shocked, we would be future nauseous. And the symptoms of future nausea, madness, anxiety, existential crisis. Does any of this stuff sound familiar? Look around, turn on the television, turn on the internet, go on to X for 5 minutes. What I'm thinking of when I think about the internet is the David Bowie interview from 1999. I think it was a BBC interview. I could be wrong. Bowie said, "I don't believe we've seen the tip of the iceberg. I think the potential of what the internet is going to do to society, both good and bad, is unimaginable." And he's right. He was right. 24 years ago, he said that. He compared the internet to an alien life form. He also said that the actual context and state of content is going to be so different to anything we envisage at the moment. In other words, what he's saying is the future is unprecedented. So that's what I think of when I read The Victorian Internet, this book by Tom Standage. It's a short read. I recommend checking it out if any of this interests you. There's a lot of great stories. One thing that I didn't even talk about that was very interesting in the book is the idea. Sometimes multiple people come up with the same idea at the same time, even though they're not connected in any way. There was a lot of people working on what ended up becoming the telegraph, but they weren't working together. So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Hopefully it was a good one. Hopefully it's good. If you're enjoying this, as I mentioned in the last episode, you can subscribe on all the major platforms, but I recommend that you go to Substack and become a paying supporter of creativeisolation.substack.com, which is also my newsletter, because there are going to be episodes that are not going to be in the free feed, including when we do a deep dive, which will be long episodes where I actually break down all of the important ideas in a book. This is just, hey, what's on the top of my head, what I remember. This is from when I listened to the audiobook. Those episodes are going to be when I actually sit down and read the book, and then probably be at least a month worth of work into each of those episodes. I think I forgot a verb there. I will be putting at least a month's worth of work into those episodes. In addition, as I said, newsletter is there. It's one of my favorite things to do. It's generally seems to hover around themes of creative process and this thing that we call being alive. It's coming from a humorous, sarcastic perspective, but also an honest and open one. So I encourage you, even if you're not interested in becoming a paid supporter, go become a free supporter. Or free supporter, I guess a free subscriber, so you can at least get those newsletters. And in addition, if you're interested in fiction, I'm working on a fiction project as a separate Substack, and that is thingthatdevours.substack.com. Of course, these, you don't have to memorize these URLs, and they're in the description. But I like to say them in case you're in the car. Let's get it into your head. So go check out the thing that devours everything. I'm trying to deconstruct what it means to do a linear storyline. It's a project that I've actually been working on for almost 15 years. I thought it was going to be a book. Turned out it doesn't work that way. It's not a linear thing. It's not going to lend itself to that. So appreciate you guys. You know what else? I'm going to say one more thing. If you liked this, tell a friend. That's how things grow.